If you enjoy this podcast, please like us on Facebook and follow us on Instagram and visit our website at lifebetweenthevines.com.
There was just a lot of reasons to stay in Livermore, and I also felt strongly at the time that Livermore was on the cusp of a real renaissance. You know, things, the Wood family, you know, Cooter Ridge, Darcy Kent, Stephen Kent, Ocasio, Nottingham, I mean, Page Mill. I'm going to forget more than I, Las Positas. The list goes on of all these new people that are doing a great job of making wine.
Discovering and tasting wine shouldn't be a homework assignment. And we believe that the people who are closest to wine have the best stories. So open a bottle.
And welcome to podcast number 564. This week we feature Mark Claren, winemaker at McGrail Vineyards and Winery, Livermore Valley. Livermore Valley is a welcoming and yet very close community, just to the east of San Francisco. By close, I mean every winemaker seems to know each other and they show a great deal of respect for the wines they make by drinking each other's wines. The wineries are just about a 15-minute drive apart, which is nice for visitors. For this podcast, I met up with Mark Claren, winemaker at McGrail Vineyards and Winery. Mark is a musician as well as a winemaker and very comfortable in each role. That's because it's passion, plain and simple. Listen to Mark on our Vino Lingo segment defining the term experienced oak. Still more interviews in Livermore, California. Having a great time out here. I am here with Mark Claren, and Mark is the winemaker at McGrail Vineyards. Notice I looked at your shirt when I did that.
Right.
How you doing, Mark?
I'm doing great, thanks.
Thank you for being on the show, I appreciate it.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Yeah. Oh, it's great. It's great to be here. As I mentioned to you before, for me, Livermore is undiscovered country, and it's a must visit in my mind. The wine here is excellent.
Well, thank you. I agree. I've been here for over 40 years of this, you know, I mean, in the wine production side, and I've seen a lot of change, and I think it's better than ever.
That's great. Glad to hear that. Where are you from originally?
I was born in Seattle, Washington, and but I moved here with my family, you know, my parents when I was a child. So I grew up in Livermore and then started working here. Then I went off to Santa Cruz, to Bonnie Doon for a little while and worked up for them, you know, had to go up to Eastern Washington because we had Riesling vineyards up there that we were sourcing from. And then I spent about a couple years in Napa making wine in a cave, which was really cool.
Yeah.
And when I came back to Livermore, I ended up meeting Ginger McGrail through a mutual friend, and sort of we hit it off, and they were very new to this. They weren't really even producing wine yet, but they wanted some help. And so I started helping them, and then eventually, about a year later or so, I ran into her in the grocery store of all places, and she said, "You know, we're thinking of hiring a winemaker." And I said, "Can I be the winemaker?" You know, so the rest is sort of history. And that's all around 2007, 2008 kind of time frame.
I'm just curious, what brought your parents to Livermore?
My father worked, he was a mechanical engineer, worked for Sandia Laboratory. And we did spend 1 year in Huntsville, Alabama. But then he came back to Sandia Lab. So yeah, we just sort of grew up here. And at the time, Livermore was basically, and still is kind of known for three things. It's the world's fastest rodeo, which was this past weekend. Mm. And then I remember on the police car, there was the atom sign, you know, the nuclear atom sign.
I didn't know that.
And then a grape cluster. So
interesting contrast.
Yeah, right.
I like that. And they still do that?
I don't think so.
Oh, it's too bad.
Just when I was a kid, yeah. They had a bronc rider, like the rodeo guy. Sure. And then and the grape cluster, and then the Atom.
Sure. And I saw all the horse trailers just riding through town, lots of them, a lot of those trailers that are both live-in as well as for horses, pretty amazing stuff. One thing you mentioned was the change you've seen in 40 years.
Sure.
How would you describe that?
Well, when I first got into the biz, I was working for the Wente family, Wente Brothers at the time, they called themselves. And really, they were making Grey Riesling and something called Le Blanc de Blancs, which was primarily Chenin Blanc and Grey Riesling, and then a Chablis, which all white wines, right? Mm. And of course, they we made a Chardonnay at the time, and they are very famous for Chardonnay. But they were primarily white wine. We did make some red wine, but not very much. And then they co-owned, at the time, they were co-owners of something called Parrot and Company, which was a marketing company co-owned with Louis Martini in Napa. Hmm. So Louis was the red and Wente was the white. And we were shipping all over the country, you know. And I remember when I first started in the biz, they would put a rail car downtown and park it, you know, on a little spur, and then we would drive down with a truck and a forklift towed behind the truck and load it, hand load the boxcar.
Wow.
And of course, I was a lot younger. that was 1979, 1980, and then about 1985, I would say, was when the Martinis and the Wentes were sort of parting ways, and the Wentes bought, I think they bought Parrot and Company or from Martini or what have you. And then that was also when we started changing grape varieties in the Livermore Valley from Grey Riesling and Chenin Blanc to Merlot, Cabernet Sauvignon, and Chardonnay. Basically, I mean, those three were the big new plantings, as it were. Mm-hmm. And we being Wente at the time, really pushed to do that because the trend, this was about the time, you know, Kendall Jackson came out with their Chardonnay in the early 80s, and they hit a home run with it. And so, you know, Wente thought, well, if they can do it, we can do it, you know, kind of thing. And then they decided that because Merlot was being, you know, that was becoming very popular too. And so it kind of made sense. And for me, the great part about that is that we discovered how well those grape varieties do here, especially the Cabernet Sauvignon and Merlot that, you know, we're growing here at McGrail, fast forward, you know, we're growing primarily Cabernet Sauvignon. And it turns out, the other difference too is we started planting the hillsides in Livermore Valley instead of just the valley floor. And I really think that the soils on the hillsides are better suited for higher quality fruit. And so, I mean, I think that was the big, huge change and kind of slowly, sort of morphed. And then the other key to change here was when the Tri-Valley Conservancy, in trying to conserve land so that it didn't become another San Jose, because you got to remember when I started, Mirasu was in San Jose producing wine, you know, and then, you know, the housing came in and just pretty soon it's like, ooh, it's noisy at night, and ooh, it smells funny, and, you know, the next thing, it's sort of like moving in next to the airport and then asking the airport to move, right? You know what I mean?
Don't work that way.
Yeah, well, it's that's basically kind of what happened to Mirasu, though, is they got squeezed out, and so, but anyway, so Wente wanted to prevent that, and so they partnered with the Tri-Valley Conservancy to preserve the land in agriculture. And part of that was, I'm not sure who you've met yet, but there's some 20-acre parcels right across the street, and another development off of Highway 84 where the people, you buy a 20-acre parcel, there's about 14 acres that are planted to vineyard, and then you have a 2-acre envelope to build your house and your swimming pool and your movie stars and all that, right? And then that sort of, you know, created some of those folks. Some of the folks just wanted to live in a vineyard, you know, for whatever reason, and the country lifestyle. But some of those folks have started their own brands. And so now, when I started in 79, I think there was 4 or 5 wine brands in Livermore. And now there's like 50.
Right. It's grown. It's amazing. But, you know, where there's good land to grow good grapes, people will go there. I want to just backpedal for a moment there. You'd mentioned Grey Riesling. Can you describe that for our listeners?
Sure. So, we call it Grey Riesling. It's actually the grape variety is Trousseau Gris, the French name of it, and it's a white. It makes a white table wine, but it's sort of gray like Pinot Gris is. The grape itself, it's bigger. It's bigger than Pinot Gris as far as the size of the berries. It's more like Semillon size. You know, it's a pretty big berry, and it just makes a, you know, really nice fruity white wine. It kind of has, I haven't tasted it in so long, but I recall sort of, you know, apple-y flavors, you know, and just easy drinking, you know, You know, just think of, you know, dry Chenin Blanc, you know, that kind of, but slightly different, you know.
Sure. Yeah, just wanted to get that out there for our listeners when you make a reference like that.
Oh, so they, for sure. No, I appreciate it.
Yeah.
It was the wine at the time. Everybody knew Grey Riesling, you know, at least locally.
Yeah.
You know, it was, and even all over the United States. But, you know, my parents drank it. I remember, you know, oh my God, Wente Grey Riesling. It was the best, right? You know, so. But unfortunately, business is business. And, you know, when Chardonnay started taking market share away from Riesling and then commanding more money, you know, the Wentys were like, we got, you know, to stay in business, we have to sort of change what we're doing because, you know, I remember Eric Wente talking about, you know, how price of milk has doubled and whatever, you know, at the time, you know, and he's like, and I can't raise the price on my bottle of wine even though my costs are going up, and, you know, because people don't, they're like, yeah, I'm bored with Grey Riesling. And, you know, you've seen the trends if you've been paying attention to the things like Merlot was like this, and then it was like this, you know. In my lifetime, I think of 8-track tapes.
Yeah. Not a bad way of putting it, actually. Yeah. Well, things change. And
nothing, VCRs, right?
Yeah, VCRs. Well, you know, but LPs have come back. Who would have thunk?
Yeah, right. Yeah,
so I can't complain about that.
No.
Just a couple of housekeeping things so I have them down. How many cases are you guys making here?
We're up to about 7,000 to 7,500.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, something like that.
As the winemaker, just curious if you do your own thing on the side for fun.
Not in the wine business. I'm a musician, so I play music.
What do you play?
I play the guitar.
Oh, cool.
And in fact, I just got back from Oregon yesterday. We played. So I've been playing in a band called the Bacchus Brothers for about 23 years.
That's kind of a record almost.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm a drummer.
Oh, are you?
And I play out,
Okay, so yeah, so you know.
Oh,
yeah. Yeah. Well, this is the same three guys.
That's amazing.
But the drummer moved to Oregon about 3 years ago, I want to say. So we don't play together very often, but he managed to get us a couple gigs up in Oregon. And he hooked us up. So we had a condo to stay in and, you know, we got paid and, you know, it was fun. And we've been playing together for so long that we really didn't. The only thing we did was we brought our acoustic instruments and did a little vocal rehearsal before, you know, the day before, or the same day, Friday afternoon, you know, before the Friday night gig. And
what kind of tunes are you playing?
We're classic rock and kind of, what is it? Somebody said we're funk, rock, classic rock, funk, blues, and maybe a little country. We play a couple reggae tunes. I mean, we're pretty diverse.
Yeah.
But if you think of classic 60s, 70s rock, that's really kind of, you know, the newest. And then we also are all songwriters, so we've produced three CDs, so of primarily original music, and so.
That's the best music, man. Sorry.
I think so. It's like 1980 hit, and it was like, but mm-mm. I mean, I know there's a lot of people that'll argue with me, but they're younger than I am. But that's what I do on the side. I mean, I was consulting for a while, and when I was, before McGrail kind of hit, you know, took off, and so at this point, McGrail keeps me busy enough. I mean, plenty busy. We started at less than 1,000 cases, and now we're at 7,500, and we bought another vineyard in the meantime, and so. And the coolest part for me about McGrail Vineyards is, you know, we're growing all of our fruit. So, you know, the good news is we control what we're, you know, growing, and I don't have to argue with the farmer about things.
Yeah.
And because I have to just look in the mirror, right?
So, yeah.
But the problem is, you know, with the fluctuations of, you know, the economy and all that kind of thing, and trying to predict where you're going to be 3 years from now has gotten more challenging as we've grown. You know, I think it's when you're, you know, at 1500 cases and you're selling out, like, you know, with no problem at all, it's easy to expand. But now that we've expanded,
definitely a different can of bananas.
Oh, yeah. We've been, the family and I have worked, I think we're a great team because, you know, I warned them about, because I have experience with fast growth, and that's just really expensive, number one.
Yeah.
And then pretty soon you lose track of, you know, who you really are. And so I think we've done a good job of trying to make sure that we maintain who we are and not get too caught up in trying to chase trends. And we're basically Cabernet Sauvignon, and yes, we make a Chardonnay, yes, we make a Sauvignon Blanc, yes, we make Merlot, we have a couple blends, you know, a little bit of rosé, and now we're doing sparkling wine.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, but these are things that we're growing, and our main focus is still Cabernet Sauvignon, and it will be. I don't see that changing unless somebody makes a movie about they're not going to drink any more Cabernet. You know?
If that person exists, yeah. I don't think they'll be very popular.
Yeah, right.
No, that'll be bad. Well, let's talk about McGrail. How long has McGrail been here?
The vineyard was planted in 1999. First harvest was 2002. Jim and Ginger McGrail, who they live here on the property and founded the property. Actually, Jim passed away about 4 years ago, but Ginger continues. And they're friends with Rhonda Wood, if you have
sure.
met her yet. I don't
know.
No,
I have not, but I know.
But you're going to then. So Wood family, she lives across the street. And I mean, it's a good walk if you're trying to get your steps in, you know.
Anything's a good walk around here.
Yeah, right. It's not like you're just gonna walk over with some butter. You know, you gotta get a backpack, but
emergency kit.
Yeah, right. But anyway, so they're good friends, and so Rhonda helped them make like a small batch of grapes. They picked them themselves and went over to Rhonda's place and, you know, crushed them and turned it into wine. And then that's when I think Jim was sort of catching the bug. And then in 2005 was a bumper crop year in California. And prior to that, they had really just wanted to sell their fruit. Well, they had extra fruit. Mm. And so they utilized like two or three different wineries and sort of did deals where you could split the fruit, you know, like here, I'll bring you 5 tons and I'll get 2.5 back as wine.
Sure, kind of like a bartering thing.
Yeah, something along those lines or whatever. And so then they did that and they started building this building that we're in. And
which is a very cool building, by the way.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
That's
I like the back too. You got the garage door style that opens up and yeah.
Oh nice. Yeah. So, but, 2000, that would probably have been about 2007, I would say. And then 2008, the doors opened here, this tasting room that we're in. And then the backside was all production, barrel storage and case storage. And there was lots of room in there at the time because, you know, it was like maybe 20 barrels, you know, it wasn't very many barrels in the scheme of life. And, you know, as an example, I have like, I don't know, 300 times three vintage, you know, I have approaching 1,000 barrels now that I'm managing.
And they're not all back there.
No, we built another building.
I figured as much.
2014, we built another building.
Is that offsite?
No, it's here. It's, you know, it's just walking distance. It's basically it's a metal building that's very well insulated and refrigerated. Anyway, so the doors opened here and they talked their daughter, Heather McGrail, into coming here and running the place. So that was 2008. By this time, I had already met Heather and during my consulting days, you know, I would come up here and I taught them how to top barrels and how to, it was funny that I taught them how to siphon wine. Well, they had fun with that, I guess.
I bet you could have some. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, like, you know, like
after a while.
Yeah. I mean, unless you're good at it, you know, you get a mouthful or whatever. Yeah. And I always joke around, you know, and say, well, you know, if you've ever siphoned gas, you figured it out real quick. You know?
But I think, and I could be wrong on this, you let me know that siphoning wine is a little more fun than siphoning gas.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. But, you know, when we were young, because I would siphon some gas. Everybody's like, oh, you were a thief. You know, I wasn't a thief. I was siphoning it out of my pickup truck so I could put it in the lawnmower because I was too lazy to go to the gas station. You know, but anyway.
Got to do what you got to do.
Well, and you know, I mean, there always seemed like a reason to. It's something we did when we were young. I mean, we did everything. You know, I worked on cars. You know, all that stuff. You know, I just feel like today everybody sits in front of a computer and plays video games, and they don't really learn how to do the necessary stuff. You know, but anyway, so Heather came along, and like I said. She actually came earlier than 2008, but because the building was here like in 2007. I can't remember when they started, but and then I think it was 2008 when Ginger said she wanted to hire a full-time winemaker, and I was like, yeah. And then at the time, it was still really a part-time job, so I still had other people I was making wine for.
Sure. I think you grow into things like that, really.
Yeah.
And
it's been perfect for me because at the time, you know, I had already done my move away. I had a job offer up in Washington State, you know, that I basically ended up turning down because I just wanted to stay local. My band, the Boxers Brothers, were here, you know, and all that. And when I moved to Santa Cruz for a little while, you know, we still played, and we sometimes played in Santa Cruz. I mean, and even with Ray being gone, I still do that. So there was just a lot of reasons to stay in Livermore. And I also felt strongly at the time that Livermore was on the cusp of a real renaissance. You know, things, people like Rhonda, the Wood family, you know, Cooter Ridge, you know, Darcy Kent, you know, Stephen Kent, Ocasio, Nottingham. I mean, you know, I'm sure I'm Page Mill. I'm going to forget more than I, you know, Las Positas, you know, the list goes on of all these new people that are doing a great job of making wine. And when you look at the scores in things like the Wine Enthusiast now, everybody's consistently, you know, hitting the 90s, and that's a really cool thing, I think.
Very cool.
You know,
yeah,
because it was really tough before. I mean, and
just to get the attention.
Well, that, and you know, the scores weren't coming. You know, the scores weren't that good. You know, like back when, you know, and people have really stepped up, and I feel like, you know, we keep continuing to try to promote the region and appreciate people like you coming out and helping us, you know. So
glad to be here, and I appreciate the association for bringing me out here.
Yeah.
But it actually brings up an interesting point, which I haven't covered on this trip, and that is distribution. I don't know if McGrail does any distribution outside the area, because obviously Livermore is not something you see everywhere at this point.
Right.
I take, for example, where I live, or even in Chicago. Is that starting to grow, or is that just a difficulty? We know distribution unto itself is difficult.
Right. So we do not have any distribution other than us. So we do sell wine. We actually have club members, I think, in Chicago. We do ship anywhere that it's legal to ship, you know, which is part of the whole problem with the wine business is...
I hear this coming.
Yeah. Well, you know, the three-tier system... And it's a holdover from, to me, I mean, I don't know for sure, but I feel like it's a holdover from Prohibition. And when the guys that were making all the money during Prohibition figured out that they weren't going to make that money anymore because it was going to be legal again,
yeah,
they decided to create a three-tier system through politics, you know, and so... And I don't know that that's true, but it just feels that way.
I wouldn't argue with that, plus you also have compliance on top of that.
Right, right. And so there's just so many rules and regulations. It's really crazy, you know. But it is what it is. And so we are self-distributed through the tasting room and our website. And primarily people come here and they taste wine and... either join the club or just buy some wine or what have you. And then locally, we're trying to get out into the Bay Area more, the San Francisco Bay Area and the South Bay, which is San Jose area. We're actually really trying to focus on San Jose. There's so many people there and there's a lot of money down there.
Yeah,
you know?
Right, it's huge.
You know, Silicon Valley, yeah, and all that, right? So
another area that's changed a lot.
Yeah. Well, that was cherry trees when I was a kid, but...
Yeah, yeah. Well, there was all kinds of farms there.
Oh, yeah. Life changes. But anyway, so we're trying to get on the into that market a little bit more, and so we have a person that's running around, you know, Walnut Creek, Danville, Pleasanton, Livermore, etc. And then we also have some people that live in Brentwood, which is north of Livermore. And so they help us distribute, you know, they basically deliver, you know.
Nice.
They make deliveries. So we can deliver, you know, kind of all over the place and, within reason, you know, but.
Well, I saw that the hotels, I think, have a program as well to do that.
Yeah,
which
right.
Which is smart.
Yeah, we have the hotels and then and some restaurants, you know, a lot of restaurants. And we're getting into more and more restaurants. And
that's a good thing.
Yeah, it is. It helps. It helps brand awareness, and you know, and it moves wine. You know,
yes, like, it does.
Gives me a reason to make more.
Okay, well, and to be able to keep a job too.
Yeah.
So, what would be the one takeaway that you would want to give to somebody who'd never been here before? The one thing you think about Livermore. What would be the main reason to come here?
Well, I mean, I think the wineries themselves, I mean, it, you know, if you're into wine, this is a great place. If you're, you know, if you're into, hiking you know, and that kind of thing, it's a great place as well. We have a lot of hiking and, you know, we have the regional park systems that, you know, that are fantastic. And then there is quite an equestrian.
I know, I've seen a lot of horses on the side of the road.
Yeah, so I mean.
Let me make that clear when I say they're not on the side of the road, they're actually being ridden.
Yeah, right, yeah.
Horse-like.
Yeah, it's, but you know, so there's a lot of that going on here. So there's a lot of diverse reasons to come here. And we have some really great restaurants. So, and I think the great restaurants tie really well with the wineries because, you know, that's kind of what people are into. When you're really into wine, you're into wine and food.
Right.
Right. And so we really, you know, I feel really great about it. And then the wineries themselves are fairly unique. Everybody's a little different. Everybody's got a little bit of a different story. But I think you've mentioned already that, you know, you feel that the wines are good. And I agree with you. I mean,
they're very good.
I'm enjoying them. And hate to say it, here's my salesman cap, we're a great value.
Yes.
We are, you know, we're not as expensive as some of the other regions that are not too far from us, you know, and I think we're a great value, bang for your buck. You know, I've had a lot of my customers tell me that they're like, man, if I was up in the four-letter word valley, you know, I'd probably pay twice what I'm paying here. You know?
Well, what's nice, too, is the ability to be able to join a wine club where you're really not killing yourself to make that payment, where the payment's reasonable, and again, you're getting excellent wine. That's not just excellent value; it's the wine, which is what it's all about.
Sure.
So, this is my favorite question to ask winemakers. So, I'll give you a minute to think about it. Okay. I'm sure you've done plenty of media over the years, interviews, talked to all kinds of people about wine. What's the one question that you've never been asked that you would like to be asked?
I know which question I hate being asked.
What question is that?
What's your favorite wine?
Oh yeah, I know. I've heard that before.
Yeah, it's what is the man? I really don't. Man, because I've been asked a lot of questions. You know, like But thank you for asking the question because it's really made me think. And you know what's going to happen is I'm going to think of it at 2 in the morning and I'll give you a call.
Give me a call. Yeah. Hey, I'll record you on the phone. I have no problem with inserting that one bit.
All right.
I'm sincerely hoping our listeners will come here and give a try to this unique area because we mentioned before the interview, it's a very laid-back area. The downtown area was hopping the last couple of nights I've been there. To come here and visit, we're just the opposite of downtown. We're out in the hills, which is, it's got these views that are just stupid.
Right.
So nice.
Yeah.
But would they come to McGrail by appointment? Can they just roll on up here? I mean, how does that work?
We do request appointments here at McGrail. We're open 7 days a week, but they're not required. But we suggest, especially on the weekends, you know, that you try to make an appointment, and because we do get pretty busy, and then if you're, I think, larger than a party of six, I think, you know, we require it, just only because we really want to be able to accommodate you well. You know, we want you're here at McGrail. I'm sure everybody's this way. We want to make sure that you have a great experience when you're here and that our staff is ready for you. You
know? That's only fair.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. And, of course, most importantly for our listeners, what is your website?
It's www.mcgrailvineyards.com. McGrailVineyards is how you spell it.
Mark, thank you for welcoming me up here again.
Yeah.
Beautiful area, beautiful view. I appreciate you taking the time today.
You're welcome. Thank you for being here.
Learn more by visiting McGrailVineyards.com. Thanks for listening. Subscribe to the podcast at lifebetweenthevines.com or sign up to our YouTube channel. You can also follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter.
Life Between the Vines comes to you from Fifth Floor Recording Company in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Produced and edited by Ray Pfister. Our host is Kay Pascoff. Our web geek is Dan Geisha. Original music by Ray Pfister. Copyright 2023.